Thank you very much, and welcome everyone to CLASP's audio conference, WorkFlex, Best Practices for Low-Wage Workers. This is Jody Lepstein, and I hope you've joined us in the past for previous CLASP audio conference calls on the working conditions of low-wage workers. If you're back for another round, we're glad you're back, and for those of you who are new, welcome. Please be sure to check out the resources page that came along with your reminder notice so you can click on to past audio conference calls on working conditions, and you can also find readily our colleague organizations' publications as well as some from us as well. My guests today are Joan Williams, the founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at Hastings College of the Law, University of California. She'll be drawing a lot from her recent work, including the Three Faces of Work-Family Conflict, and from an upcoming piece that zeroes in on just one face, those that are low-paid, particularly single moms. Also check out, if you haven't already, her recent book, Reshaping the Work-Family Debate, Why Men and CLASP Matter. And there's, by the way, an asterisk at the end of that, I think. Welcome, Joan. How are you?
Delighted to be here, Jody. Thanks for the invitation.
Sure thing. And we're also joined by Laura Geigler. Laura, have I pronounced your last name correctly?
Yes, that's correct.
Oh, wow. Okay, so we're joined by Laura Geigler, director.
Oh, no, sorry. It is Geiger without the L.
Oh, okay. Laura Geiger, director of human resources at Turk, Inc. in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Laura will be drawing on what she does every day, the practices of Turk. Turk is a manufacturer of industrial automation products. The Minneapolis business is a subsidiary of an international firm that originated in Germany. And the great news, Laura, right, is that the Minneapolis Star Tribune just named Turk a 2010 top workplace. Most importantly, the winners got that honor at the Star Tribune only if their employees said they deserved it. Congratulations, Laura.
Thank you. Yes, that was quite an honor.
Wonderful. The purpose of our call today, the overarching goal, is to zero in on actionable steps to enhance workplace flexibility that's responsive to lower wage workers' needs. Our focus is going to be on best practices and policies. From time to time, you know, we can't help it. We'll be hearing from some data and maybe some research. But really today is to try and look at what's actually working out there and to highlight solutions and tips for ideas about how to move forward an agenda around WorkFlex for low-wage workers. A housekeeping detail. We will be dividing the call into four subject areas, starting off with paid leave, then moving into scheduling issues, the child and elder care, and then the fourth area is employment engagement. We encourage you to send in your questions as they occur to you. It's simple, and it's a simple address. Just send in your questions to audioconference@clasp.org. Again, that's audioconference@clasp.org. To set the stage first, though, Laura, can you give us a quick overview of the Turk Minneapolis workforce? Again, we're focused on the lower end of wages, so we'd like to just know about Turk Minneapolis overall, but then again about the percentage of your workforce, which is sort of on the lower end of the scale.
Sure. Well, just to give an overview, Turk is a German-owned company. Turk was the last name of the founders in the industrial automation industry. We have about 400 people in the Minneapolis area, and as we're a manufacturing company, we have a large production population, roughly 50% falling into the category that you described from an income perspective.
Well, Laura, I don't know if you've had a chance to check out Joan's publication that she did with Heather Boucher called The Three Faces of Work-Family Conflict, but there they divide the workforce into basically thirds so that there's a bottom 30% for household income. Trying to use that framework, realizing that you don't have household income, but you have wages, can you give us a sort of a rough feel for how much of the Turk workforce might fit that definition with all the caveats I just added on? Just something rough so that our audience has some sense, since they're interested in lower wage workers, you know, what you've got going at your own company.
Yep. Yeah, and I would say that is about 50% from what I understand from Joan's work.
And realizing the caveats that you don't have household income. So it's a big,
exactly.
big caveat, but which just gives us a rough sense. All right. So,
exactly.
You know, one thing I was struck, Laura, in the materials you sent me is what said in your mission statement. It includes this assertion, and I'm absolutely going to quote it because I think people will be thrilled to hear this. It says, our mission is to provide employees with a stimulating, motivating, and rewarding work environment. You know, that's great in and of itself that you put that on the page, but how do you know if you're actually accomplishing this mission?
Well, it's something that we obviously have to monitor over time, and so we've done this by getting employee feedback and input, such as doing employee surveys, company-wide focus groups, to better understand what our employees' perspectives are, to listen to them, and hear their feedback. So what we've done, too, is not only looked at ourselves internally, but also comparing to other companies in our geographic area who have taken the same survey at the same time, knowing that there's different things going on with the economy and the external world, so that we can get a better sense of where our strengths as an organization to build on and where are some of our development areas that we continuously strive to improve upon. So these are things that are looking at, you know, what are the engagement levels, what are some of the issues or frustrations, things they want us to follow up on. But a lot of the positive feedback we've heard is that a top strength for us that's come through both in our surveys and our focus groups is around the area of being a flexible employer who, you know, values work-life balance for our employees, and really it's due to, you know, the family-friendly culture, the leaders who really care and want to do the right thing for each person, and it's also aligning well with the supportive policies and, you know, generous paid time off and excellent benefits that we offer.
That's great, Laura. And, you know, it's really interesting that you do try and develop a whole set of metrics to see how you're doing with respect to, you know, your own workers supporting that your language is, in fact, being matched by action. And I want to turn to Joan because I think, you know, we hear a lot about employers who verbalize this idea that employees are their best asset. But when it comes to lower-wage workers particularly, they don't seem to be providing paid leave or even making other kinds of flexibility available. You know, sometimes when higher-wage workers in the same firm are getting those kinds of flexible arrangements, what's your take or your overall sense as to why this goes on? If employees are your best asset, why aren't they investing in them?
Well, the literature shows that workers at the high end of the economic spectrum, the top of the heap, are employers see them as trusted workers who can handle flexibility and handle a lot less supervision. The traditional take, and I have to say Turk is a really dramatic exception to this, is that workers at the bottom of the heap are not trusted workers, that these are workers who have commitment problems, maybe aren't job ready, are irresponsible, and consequently employers have set up a system for those workers that is very rigid and highly supervised. One thing that current research has begun to show is that it is not so much these workers' irresponsibility that has created the problem of very, very high attrition among low-wage workers. In fact, much of the extremely high turnover and expensive turnover that employers encounter among low-wage workers is not because they are irresponsible workers, but because they're responsible family members, and that employers unknowingly in themselves are fueling this high attrition because they are setting up extremely unstable schedules that are quite simply impossible for these workers to manage. And so employers have set up, sadly, many times a situation where low-wage workers have a lot of workplace flexibility, but it's called quitting over and over and over again. And employers look at that and they say these are irresponsible workers. But in fact, the employers have a lot more control over how to create conditions where workers can show up consistently and do their jobs with very good morale.
And I will want to try and drill down into some tips about the flexibility that workers have around those. What I'd first like to do, though, Laura, with you, is zero in on how Turk uses a paid time off bank approach to paid leave. First, can you fill us in on about how much time workers actually get off under your paid time off bank?
Sure. Our policy is set up so that it's based on years of service. So new people who are joining the organization start out with 17 days of paid time off per year, which could be used for any reason that's important to them, and they can reach up to 30 days per year based on years of service. So, you know, from 3.5 weeks to over 6.5 weeks, depending on how long they've been with the company, plus, you know, holiday pay in addition to that.
So this is, when you say it's available to a new employee, does that mean from the day they become a new employee?
Yes, we actually, we used to have a crew on a monthly basis, but we changed it so that they are able to get a bank of time when they start, and then also, you know, every year in January they just get, you know, the large sum of PTO that just gets dropped into their account to be able to use at their convenience.
Play this out for us as an HR manager in terms of the pros and cons to paid time off banks as compared to having discrete reasons attached to paid time, like a discrete set of paid sick days or a discrete set of vacation days. What do you see as the pros and cons?
Well, you know, when I started at Turk, we did actually have separate banks for, you know, sick, personal, vacation, floating holiday vacation, bonus hours, all separate banks that we had to manually keep track of. And, you know, everybody had to, you know, state specific reasons, or if they were using, you know, sick time, they had to bring a doctor's note, all these things that we just found, you know, didn't make a lot of sense for us as an organization when we're trying to just promote people to take time away from work to spend time to enjoy their life with their family, friends, you know, if they're sick to stay home. But also if they're not sick and they just need a day away from work for, you know, a stress-free day to go fishing, that they don't have to say they're sick to use their sick time, that they can just take some time to play with their kids. So what we did was just combined all of the hours that that they otherwise would have received into one bank called Pay Time Off and said, you know what, this is your time to use and you don't have to give us a reason for why you're using it.
Well, can I ask you to maybe riff a little bit off of what Joan was saying earlier about the distrust of lower wage workers? You know, we have all heard about employers who say they don't want to implement anything like a paid sick days program because it will be abused by workers. Do you feel that having a PTO bank approach enhances or gets around this trust issue because what you're offering is saying you get to decide how you use this time and I'm not watching what it is you're doing? Does that enhance trust, or is it necessary to have trust first in order to implement that kind of an approach?
Well, I mean, I would say as an organization have not had trust issues from that perspective, but for us it just seemed like the right thing to do. But I can see where, you know, based on what Joan is saying, you know, it would probably help to enhance trust at a company that doesn't have anything, because really, you know, if in some cases, depending on how your policy is set up and you're saying you can only use this time for very specific reasons, then, you know, maybe they have another reason, but it's also very valid. Well, then you're almost forcing that person to lie. And why do that? If you want to set time available for people to take care of their family needs, then just allow them to do so and do it with flexibility and with trust.
Okay, well, and Laura, I know you have a set of business reasons, though, as well, for pursuing paid time off banks. Fill us in on those.
Well, we decided to put the PTO policy in place and combine all of the banks just to help from a business process perspective. Okay. Obviously, there's timekeeping involved. In fact, at the time we did this, which was probably 5 or 6 years ago, I was, you know, managing the payroll administration aspects and doing all of the timekeeping manually. So we decided to automate this process and use an online system, and also just to take the headache away from all of the managers who are going to be also, you know, tracking their own time and employees as well, to be able to just say, you know what, you just took your time off, you used your PTO, and you don't need to say anything more about it. and taking away that data entry manual process obviously allowed a lot more time for people to do more value-added work along with that as well.
We get the value of reducing paperwork. That sounds good.
Yeah.
So, but clarify who actually gets the PTO bank. It appears to be available to your regular full-time employees. Does this include hourly full-time workers at starting wages, which are $10 to $16, or is it divided in some other way?
Nope, it doesn't matter what your income is. Everybody who is 30 hours or more, which is the high majority of our workforce, they're all eligible for the number of PTO days that I described previously.
So you were saying that 30 hours or more, you have 400 employees. About how many of them are not considered full-time or 30 hours or more? Is it like 20% or just a handful? How many people are we saying?
It's actually just a small handful who are in the less than 30-hour category. And actually, that group of people includes our front desk area, which is people who have decided to, jointly we decided to create a job sharing situation so that these were people who could manage their time among themselves as a team. So what would happen in the case of a person who is, communication center operator who is sick or their son is sick or they want to switch days, they can call one of their other team members and or their manager to help facilitate the process, and then they can come in on another day and swap days so that they can still have a flexible schedule and not lose out on their hours.
I want to thank all of you in the audience who are sending questions in, and I want to remind everybody about how to send in questions. Just send an email to us now at audioconference@clasp.org. Laura, in addition to the paid time off bank, we have a set of other kinds of ways of helping workers find time. For example, Turk supports parental involvement in a child's education by allowing workers who have worked half-time or more to have up to 16 hours of unpaid leave each year to attend to school-related activities, anything from meeting with a teacher to going into a school event. Are parents actually taking this up? And here's a funky question for you, I guess. As an HR person, are you hearing from non-parents that they resent this time that parents get to have?
Your first question, yes, parents do take advantage of this. And regarding the second question, I personally have never heard of any complaints from other team members who do not have children that they're resentful. I think people know when they join the company that we are a family-friendly company, and that's just how we operate, and there's not been complaints about that to my knowledge.
Well, it doesn't end there in terms of the ways you all are working on work-life issues. You have a newly designed, I believe, work-life pursuit policy. Maybe it's not that new, in which workers have the right to request a 1 to 3 month sabbatical or a part-time position. Again, there's always the question, are workers actually using this provision? And how easy or hard has it been for managers?
Well, I guess, the question about whether it's new. It's new as a formal policy, I would say. The culture has supported it for a long time, but we wanted to make it formal so that people knew that they could open up a dialogue and discussion with their manager about, wanting to take, a longer maternity leave or wanting to just work a part-time schedule for a while to attend to what's going on in their life or with a parent, or maybe they just wanted to do some volunteering. We also have a lot of our production population who, they wanted to go home for an extended trip to visit their family in their home country. And so this policy has really supported them in letting them actually take, up to an extended leave of 3 months to just go spend time with their family. And we do have people who are out on those sabbaticals as of right now. We do encourage people to use it and state that it's for a variety of reasons, whether it's you know, they have a passion outside of work. Maybe they want to write a book. Maybe they want to travel, volunteer. You know, that's obviously why we call it work-life pursuit.
All right. And Joan, in three faces, you have a list of policies for what you call, quote unquote, an all-American family-friendly political coalition, and cite a congressional bill that would give workers the right to request a flexible schedule. Again, that's a right to request a flexible schedule. It's not a right to automatically get that flexible schedule. It's something that you say would benefit those across the income spectrum. Absent legislation, one practical step is to train supervisors around work flexibility and how to achieve it. Could you sort of fill us in?
Yes. There's been legislation suggested, but it hasn't gone through the Congress with lightning speed. One practical step that employers can use absent legislation is, number one, creating the kind of workplace culture that Laura's been talking about so eloquently at TURC. But another step is to adopt a training that has been developed by Ellen Kosick and Leslie Hammer, two members of Work Life Law's working group on flex and low-wage jobs. And Leslie Hammer and Ellen Kosick have addressed something that is very, very profoundly present in the literature, which is that particularly for low-wage workers, the single most important factor in whether or not they feel they can balance their work and their family needs is whether they have a supportive supervisor. And so Ellen and Leslie have developed a very simple, straightforward supervisor training and have used it in an experimental context and found that it does indeed help workers balance work and family, which does indeed lead to lower attrition and more workplace commitment by their workers. And this is one of the effective practices that Work Life Law will be featuring in our upcoming report on flex and low-wage jobs.
And is this material on Ellen Kosick's website right now?
You know, I don't know because, as I say, I got it through the working group. We have assembled the leading researchers in this arena and have been meeting with them for the past year. And
okay.
Bringing together their best practices.
Great. Well, we will also check, and if it's available currently, we'll put it on our list of resources, which will be included in our follow-up mailing to all of the registrants. So, and, of course, we'll be linking to your report when it comes out, Joan, and there'll be another chance to get these materials as they come out. So, Joan, I know you and this working group, the researchers particularly, who have been in the field for so many years testing out these ideas, like Ellen Kosick, whom you just mentioned, have identified a set of small steps that could make a huge difference, particularly for low-wage workers, around these flexibility issues. Could you give us a few illustrations of those maybe smaller, less expensive, or no-expense steps?
There are a lot of no-expense steps, and I'll mention just a few. One is that employers should recognize that among these low-wage families, many of them have children going home alone from school, often in dangerous neighborhoods. And the research shows that sometimes this is 8-year-olds taking 6-year-olds home as latchkey kids. And so what is happening now in many, many workplaces is that their moms are sneaking into the ladies' room to make a call to make sure they are they're home safely. And so it's really an employer's best interest to either schedule a break then or make some other provision to allow these moms to do what any responsible parent would do, which is just make a call to make sure the kids are home safely. So that one is very much a light lift. Little heavier, but not that complicated, also is to redesign overtime systems. Many times overtime systems make overtime mandatory, and often it's at short notice. And those are actually what I call the let's fire the single mothers and tag teamer systems, because if you have a tag team family, and one parent is ordered to work overtime at short notice, then the mom has to choose between dad's job, the family has to choose between dad's job and mom's job in a context where they need both jobs to pay the mortgage. So employers can do some very concrete things. They can, number one, first try to rely on voluntary overtime, since in many workplaces there's a group of workers who really, really want the overtime because of the time and a half pay, and another group of workers who might want it but just couldn't take it because they have childcare responsibilities. So making overtime systems voluntary is a first step. Now, sometimes as employers, we all know that that is not going to solve the problem, and you may need to go to a mandatory overtime call, even if you because you don't have enough volunteers. And in that context, either you can give notice of the voluntary overtime, which is something that Turk does, or if that's impossible, and realistically sometimes it is impossible, you can divide your workers into four groups and tell them, look, if you're going to be on call for unexpected overtime, it will be in the first week of the month. A relatively easy thing, and it would really decrease both stress on tag team working families and working single working moms, and also ultimately save the employer money by decreasing unwanted attrition among otherwise very responsible workers.
Thanks a very lot on all of those points. You know, we have a question here for you, Laura, from Willow Krybeck, who's with Grass Tops and the Minnesota Paid Sick Days Coalition. So she's a neighbor, at least in the same state. Willow asks, as you went about creating and implementing these policies, what was the response from the local business community? And what was the response from within your industry? And the final part of her question to you is, do you now feel like others are turning to Turk as the local or industry example of the difference investing in your workforce can make?
Well, to be honest, a lot of these things are not new. I mean, this is really more of what I would describe as the Turk culture that has been around for, you know, over 20 years. And, you know, it's always had this, you know, this family-friendly feel. Obviously, we've made progress over time, which has been evident. I would say we haven't really been doing a lot of, you know, promoting it in the local community. So I'm not sure all of our neighbors know about all the things that we're doing. I mean, this is, you know, one of the few times that we're actually talking about it outside of, you know, letting our employees know. And they obviously share with their family members who probably talk to others in the community. And so therefore we get a lot of family members who want to continue to come to work at Turk and internal referrals and things like that. But it's certainly something that we're happy to share our story with others, and if there's other companies who are interested in you know, how do we do it, we're happy to share what's worked for us with them.
Well, Laura, the Center for Law and Social Policy is delighted to keep your line busy, and as we work with employers around the country, we will for sure make sure they hear this audio conference, so that they can hear about all the things that you're doing and be right in touch with you. So I hope you're looking forward to a busy signal quickly. Well, Laura, lots of companies, including yours, have a points or demerits system around absences. This has often come up in the context of paid sick days, where companies that provide paid sick days on the one hand also count it against the employee on the other when they have a no-fault absenteeism policy. Can you explain how you all at Turk use the point system to help with your management, and whether someone who uses PTO bank days to take care of an elder, for example, whether they might have some kind of discipline action against them for that reason?
Well, I think this goes back to, you know, why we don't specify you have to be sick and why we have it the pay time off bank instead, because I couldn't imagine a situation where someone who uses PTO to take care of an elder would ever have a discipline action against them, because, again, we're such a family-friendly company, and our general attendance policy doesn't exist, you know, to prevent abuse, or I should say it does exist to prevent abuse, but no occurrence or point is given to any situation that would be, a Family or Medical Leave Act related absence. And in fact, even beyond that, we give our managers the discretion, because we trust them as leaders, to do the right thing and excuse absences using their best judgment, knowing that, you know, Turk supports them as we're a flexible employer and we want to strive to be family friendly for all of our people.
Okay, well, Joan, in your bag of tips there, do you have a tip or two for ways to adjust no-fault absenteeism policies in this arena?
Absolutely. As part of work life laws work, both with employers and also with unions, we have studied union arbitrations and built a database so that we can get an idea of the kinds of problems that workers are having surrounding work-family issues. And there are some really dramatic cases that, I must say, sort of shock the conscience. One arbitration I remember was where a woman who was working on a factory line received a call saying that her four-year-old had fallen down in the playground and had a head injury and was headed to the emergency room. And, of course, the mother left immediately to join her four-year-old in the emergency room. And as a result of one of these progressive discipline policies, that was the last point, and she was fired. And I must say that in a unionized context, you can imagine the response of an arbitrator to this kind of situation if the discipline or discharge is grieved. Arbitrators basically say, no, I don't think so. We're not going to allow this woman to be fired. It's not just cause to fire her for joining her four-year-old in the emergency room. But even in non-unionized contexts, I think it's really important, and Laura said it very eloquently, you don't want to put your workers in a situation where they have to lie in order to be responsible family members. That is just does nobody any good and corrodes workplace trust and workplace commitment. And so if you have one of these no-fault progressive discipline systems, and most places do, it's very important to include an exception for family emergencies. And this is one thing that Turk does, and they have graciously agreed to share that policy with the world, and it will be in our forthcoming report.
Joan, let me ask you a question from Robin Runge here with the University of North Dakota School of Law, and I'm going to excerpt her question. Basically, she's asking if there's research or data that shows that paid time off can result in less employee turnover, and in turn, if there is reduced turnover on the part of the employee, does that enhance the employee's ability to move up the career ladder more readily? Joan?
There is a tremendous amount of research on the business case for adopting policies that effectively match your workplace to the workforce that actually exists today. Sadly, many policies in many companies are perfectly designed for the workforce of 1960, the breadwinner housewife workforce. As we all know, that's gone with the wind. In terms of developing the business case for these kinds of workplace policies, I think it's important to recognize that that if you try to figure out the business case for one particular kind of intervention, such as adjusting your your progressive discipline policy, or just allowing people to use leave banks, et cetera, that is going to be a very, very, very mushy number. But what is a much harder number is to understand what kinds of costs employers incur if they set up a very rigid workplace based on the assumption that every responsible worker has a wife at home taking care of his kids, which, of course, as we know in today's workforce, is complete science fiction. that kind of workplace, whether it's fueled by the misapplication of no-fault absenteeism policies or whether it's fueled by extremely unstable schedules, is going to fuel extremely high levels of attrition. And, in fact, in our working group has documented levels of attrition up to 400% among these workers. Now, the good news is that our working group has also documented attrition close to 1% among these workers, and that's what employers have control over. These are, by and large, not irresponsible workers.
Okay.
Let's
turn to some scheduling issues now that we've sort of taken up a set of questions around paid leave. And Joan, first for you, when we talk about scheduling flexibility, you know, it's often about trying to adjust, you know, start and stop times, being more responsive to the ongoing after-school needs of children, those kinds of issues. But let's zero in on something that gets too little attention, which is the unpredictability of schedules. Often there are particularly retail businesses which have and practice just-in-time scheduling that requires managers to maintain a certain ratio between the sales staff and customers. And to achieve that, managers often post schedules with very, very short notice, which can, of course, wreak havoc with child care and elder care and more. What some best practice tips for addressing this kind of unpredictable schedule?
Well, this is going to be one major theme of Work-Life Law's forthcoming report, because the answer is a little complicated. Let me give a bit of a snapshot. What the working group researchers have shown is that often these just-in-time schedules actually end up costing the employers money. And here's why. The employers think that they're saving money by keeping this tight fit between supply and demand, but if you have a schedule that's extremely unstable, particularly with low-wage workers who depend on family and friends for childcare, this kind of schedule ends up fueling attrition to sky-high levels. And moreover, although the employers think that they're saving money and they think that these hours are extremely unstable and there's nothing they can do to control them, we are going to provide a worksheet that allows employers to assess just how unstable the schedules are, because one of our researchers has documented that in a particular retail workplace, in fact, 80% of the hours are stable. And this is not something the employer had actually recognized. And so part of this, and so much of this, is simply changing business processes to allow employers to match their workplace to the workforce that they actually employ.
Let's turn to another topic, which is shifts. You know, sometimes you get assigned a shift, but it needs to be changed because you have some kind of schedule conflict. And CLASP, I don't remember even how many years ago now, we wrote up about a McDonald's effort in which they piloted at McDonald's a shift swapping program that allowed family members working at the same McDonald's to change their shift within the family without even mentioning it to a supervisor. As long as the shift was covered, everybody was behaving appropriately. And it's my understanding that the evaluation was done and it's been rolled out in a whole lot of McDonald's, not just this pilot anymore. What are some other practical tips, Joan, for dealing with the need to shift shifts?
Well, the shift swapping program is a very good program. In unionized context, there are some complex issues that need to be involved, and we will be talking about them. So there's really two ways employers can focus on this workplace, this schedule instability. One is by recognizing that there's a lot more instability in shifts now than there needs to be. And the other is thinking hard where there is inevitable schedule instability, and I'm an employer, sometimes there is, to designing workplace processes so that the employer ends up with the workers that he or she needs at the time that he or she needs them, but the employees have some notice, or else, if you cannot give them notice, that you're tapping the part of your workforce who is just happy, for example, for the overtime and doesn't really need the stability that people with family responsibilities needs. And so we are developing a sets of best practices, number one, to help employers do a higher quality analysis of how much instability there inevitably is in their workplaces, much less than many of them think today, and number two, to provide a palette of options for employers where there is instability to make sure that the employees who simply want more hours, period, get take up the slack where they need to be called into work.
Laura, do you have some tips to add on best practices related to shifts and the individualized needs of workers?
Sure. Well, our leaders really have a lot of discretion on doing what is best for each of their teams. And if they want to work on an individual level with any of their team members to be more flexible while also meeting business needs, you know, we have team members who have, you know, they're working compressed work weeks while still ensuring enough coverage for the work that needs to get done, others who telecommute regularly, others who just, you know, they need to pre-plan around, you know, whatever is going on with their family. And, you know, our supervisors strive to give, you know, a week or more notice in cases of scheduled overtime or, you know, whenever possible, always allowing for voluntary overtime, which a lot of people, you know, jump on the chance to do that when extra hours are available. So, you know, in the case of the front desk that I mentioned earlier, you know, that is a group where they have an option because they are job sharing to say, look, let's just swap days, and, you know, we know that what needs to be covered to meet our customers' needs, and because the leader of that team is very flexible and just believes in, you know, letting them work it out and trusting them to make it happen. It's been working really well for everyone involved.
Well, can you amplify that a little bit? Because, Laura, we have a question here from Caitlin, who's with 9to5, and she asks, how does Turk maintain production and afford such flexible policies, given that any day a good fraction of workers could be using time off? Do you hire temps? If so, do these temps get the same benefits? So it's a question about how you make it work.
Yeah, and yes, we do hire temps. And I want to say that, you know, usually it's between 10 and 20%, knowing that we do have paid time off policies and we expect people to use their time. So the temps are, you know, obviously to help ensure that we can have that flexibility, and also because as an employer and also as a company, we want to be flexible for our customers to meet their needs. So, but the temps are not necessarily Turk temps. They are, you know, employed by another employer who has their own set of benefits. But from a production perspective, I'd say, you know, 99% of all the people who are hired on as a full-time employee start as a temp first, and then they end up, you know, coming on to our payroll over time, you know, after they've been trained, and as our capacity requires us to add additional full-time regular employees.
And do the supervisors work with the employees for a scheduled absence using paid time off to try and balance the production workforce? In other words, I think that's part of what Caitlin's asking. Is there any effort to say if everybody comes in with a request, the idea that they're going to be gone 3 weeks in July, how do you smooth that out so that you don't have everybody gone in July?
Well, you know, that's actually a great question for our production supervisors who obviously manage that on a day-to-day basis.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I mean, all I can say is you know, these are people who care and, you know, people who've been there, and they do what they can to meet everyone's needs. And to be fair, You know, we don't try to put a lot of, you know, HR policies around how do you do that, because we just want people to use common sense and just do the right thing. So I can't speak to specific details on that particular instance.
Okay. Well, we may follow up with you and post something if we can send it out to our registrants if there's a short, sweet answer as opposed to just being a very wise supervisor who can make it work.
Well, yeah, I have to get that from our supervisor.
Exactly. You know, we have about 15 more minutes, and what I'd like to try and do is squeeze in some questions on our two topic areas. And Joan, first, with you about child care and elder care, and this one actually is about kids. In the UK, I remember identifying and working with a winning company that took into account the scheduling mismatch between the school calendar, in which kids were off for the summer months but parents were at their jobs, and a firm which heard from the parents that this was deeply troubling to them. So in collaboration with the workers, they developed a special program for the summer months where the firm relied a lot on college students in a temporary way. That's a practical solution, but it may not be feasible for many firms or for all workers. But fill us in on the idea that I know you've been looking into, which is temporary on-site childcare.
This is something that some unions have negotiated for in their contracts. For example, all of us who have or had children at home at one point know the headache where you wake up and there is 5 inches of snow, and I lived in Washington, D.C. at the time, and school was, of course, canceled if there was the smell of snow in D.C., and mom and dad have to go to work, and what do they do? So in some unions worked out with their employers that in that context they would offer a program for children on the job, and they would take an empty room, and they had an arrangement with not only childcare, because this is mostly older kids, but a provider who would run enrichment and fun programs for that day. And that's on a short-term basis. Also, of course, we all know that it's Columbus Day, it's Veterans Day, it's whatever day, and the kids don't have school, but the parents have work. And so that's, of course, dead easy, where you make an arrangement with a provider who comes, and your kids, your workers' kids, can come to work and have a fun day. And you know, I can't kid you. This is out of pocket for the employer. On the other hand, if the employer calculates the levels of absenteeism that fall as a result of these programs, the many employers can find that they're actually saving money by offering these programs, not to mention that's the short-term savings, but the long-term savings. And I think Turk's experience really dramatizes this when you think about their attrition rates. If you help out your workers, you get an extremely loyal workplace. And this is all the more true for low-wage workers because, unfortunately, in this country, because of this image of these workers as workers who aren't trusted as much, you can become a very an employer of choice without doing very dramatic things.
Well, Joan, we're talking about caregiving, and you've had a leading role in shaping the debate around caregiver discrimination, and in fact, you may have coined that term. Could you just explain for all of us what that actually means and what progress you're seeing in this arena?
Dramatic progress. When work-life law was founded 10 years ago, the common knowledge was that you couldn't sue based on work-family conflict. We turned that around, and basically the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission adopted the approaches that work-life law had pioneered in their guidance in 2007. Sadly, though, research shows that discrimination against mothers is actually the strongest form of workplace discrimination. So if you give people identical resumes, one but not the other a mother, the mother is nearly 80% less likely to be hired, 100% less likely to be promoted, and offered an average of $11,000 in salary. There's been a 400% increase in these caregiver discrimination suits in the last 10 years, and work-life law runs a hotline for people who fear who feel they've been unfairly treated on the job because of their family responsibilities, and we try to help them work it out with their employers or refer them if there's been a violation of legal rights. But let me just give you one story or two stories if we have time. That we received through
we got one hotline.
We kept getting calls from women in low-wage jobs who were getting drug tests, and somehow the drug tests only were given to the women, and the people who were pregnant got magically fired after the drug test. So of course these were pregnancy tests. And this is the kind of behavior that does shock the conscience, but sadly it happens. And when workers' rights are being violated in this way, we would really urge people to call into our hotline to remedy that kind of situation.
Laura, it's impossible to have Turk on the phone as a high road employer and not ask about employee engagement and well-being. Because you, in fact, are emphasizing that with your workforce. Typically, employer training for lower-wage workers is limited. They often only get what they need by way of training to perform very specific tasks. Could you fill us in on what Turk does more broadly for its employees?
Sure. We encourage any and all employees who are interested in training and development to take advantage of internal and external training, and in fact are even showing our support through incentivizing them to do so with our new well-being benefit, which focuses on the five elements of well-being as defined by Gallup's research, which includes career, social, physical, financial, and community well-being. And so with that, we've been offering on-site trainings every month to all employees on company time on topics ranging from stress management and relaxation techniques to nutrition, healthy grocery shopping and cooking on a budget, healthy family topics, financial planning training, and other things like in the future we'll be offering life balance coaching as well.
Well, looking at this expanded well-being program, you used to just focus in on health, literally, mm-hmm. and now you've got these other domains. Have you had any surprises in terms of employee reaction to the new offering?
I guess not necessarily surprising. I don't know if surprising is the right word. I mean, one of the new things that we offered recently to help support, the community well-being aspect, which was to also roll out, a company matching program, meaning, we've asked our employees, to think about what's most meaningful for them, outside of work in terms of, supporting the improvement of quality of life for others, through, volunteering or contributing money to a charitable organization of their choice. And so, we're putting our money where our mouth is and basically saying we'll match up to $100 of wherever an employee wants to contribute in terms of what's meaningful for them, and also match up to 2 days of paid time off for them to volunteer. And I mean, from what I can see so far, that's a well-received new policy that we've implemented. We're trying to put more emphasis around the whole area of career well-being as well. And
what does that mean?
Basically, career well-being, as Gallup defines it, is liking what you do each day, and so we're asking people to spend time thinking about what are your strengths and how can you build on your strengths, and now we're asking them, if they want to, if it's meaningful for them, which we heard for some of our employees through our focus groups that career development is important to them. So we've created a new role where we actually developed and promoted one of our HR people to be an HR development partner who can talk to people about putting a development plan in place. If they want to go back to school, we have company-supported tuition reimbursement for any position that they may attain within the company. So we've had a number of people over the years who have been moving up and around the company from all over as a result of, taking advantage of going back to school and also just the general support of our leaders who want to support their team members' growth. So it's certainly not an area where we're perfect or where we need to be or where we're striving to be, but it's certainly an area that we've put more and more emphasis on and will continue to do so in the future. But, you know, from a company perspective, our turnover rates have reflected that all of these things combined have had an effect. We've had less than 2% voluntary turnover since 2004 on average. So, you know, the only downside of having little to no turnover and being a company of only 400 in the U.S., there's not a lot of layers, you know, of management, as you can imagine. And so so there's not always a lot of places that, you know, turnover to move into. So that's the one downside of low turnover, but certainly it's still a good problem to have.
It sounds like a delightful problem to have. And Laura, you shared with me that this well-being program with all of its component parts is actually managed through an incentive plan. Could you explain what the incentive is and how it all works?
Sure. Well, we've been having incentives around the area of health and wellness for several years now, but we've recently expanded it to a more holistic perspective on well-being and, you know, have asked people to really think about what is most important to them. And we started the process by giving them a health and well-being assessment, which is administered through a third party so that they are assured of confidentiality and anonymity in how they're responding and really making them more aware of their overall health and well-being and thinking, you know, help them to think about what is most important to them in terms of an area that they want to either maintain, you know, their current well-being or improve it in the future. And then beyond that, where we now have a two-day-a-week on-site well-being coach who is, again, employed by another third party so that, you know, they have a sense of when they meet with her to talk about their well-being goals and their action plans to help meet what's important to them, but that's not information that's going to be shared back with anyone in management or HR at Turk, but it's really a resource for them to use to focus in on what's important to them. And then with that, we have a lot of, you know, ongoing every month different opportunities for them to address all of the five elements of well-being to, you know, just support them and encourage and give them resource to meet their own personal goals.
In closing, I'd like to ask both of you to address the same question. For employers of low-wage workers who are out there in the listening audience either today or in the future, and similarly for advocates who work on behalf of low-wage employees or approaching low-wage employers, what would you advise be the main message to employers about why they should extend flexible working arrangements in all of the different ways we've described today to lower wage workers? Laura, you're up first.
Okay. That's a tough question to capture it all in one, but I mean, ultimately for Turk, you know, it's just truly really about caring about your people. And, you know, as our president and CEO, Dave Lagerstrom, just recently, you know, wrote to me as we're talking about this, you know, without our employees, we are nothing. And it's true. I mean,
but can you say that again? That sounded like a great quote, but I don't know that I heard the piece at the end. Say it again. This is from your CEO?
Yes, he just said, you know, without our employees, we are nothing. And you know, to me, that's a statement that's beyond saying, you know, they're our most valuable asset. But, I mean, literally, you know, our employees are the people who make it happen each day. And, you know, it's not just the leaders who are supportive, but, you know, the team members themselves. They come to each other's aid to help out and are flexible with each other. You know, they go above and beyond if somebody has a life hardship outside of work to help out. And obviously the company tries to support in any way we can with those things. So for us, and I would think for any organization, it's really about the culture of the organization. And the culture is set by the people, and it's supported by the top of the organization, and it's critical, and it's what really makes the difference. At least that's what makes the difference at our company.
Thank you. And Joan, your message.
To to employers. I guess the message to employers, I would say, is something very, very simple, is that you need to reevaluate your business processes to make sure that the very high attrition among suffered by many employers of low-wage workers is not something that you yourself as the employer are inadvertently producing. And that if you do that, you will often see that there are different ways of different business processes that can improve your bottom line. And that's really the very important point.
Thank you both. I want to thank the audience for joining us today, and I want to thank my guest, Joan Williams, of the Center for Work-Life Law, and I want to thank Laura Geiger with Turk, Inc. in Minneapolis, for giving us their time today, sharing their work, and sharing their resources, which we will be circulating to all of the participants in this audio conference call today and whoever sees the post in the future. So have a great day, everybody. Thank you very much.